Okay. Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here at our kitchen table at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And I want to mention a little bit, we have a birthday coming up. A birthday as in this fine community radio station is going to be 10 years old. Can you believe it? 10 years of good stuff in your ears. And one thing I want to mention is all the people that make this possible. This is a volunteer-driven organization, and almost every time we have a show, I mention our kitchen table. And actually, I want to thank the person that built this kitchen table that we're sitting around. It's beautiful. It's not really a kitchen table, folks, but I'm using the drama and the creativity of your mind to imagine that. But it's a beautiful table that we're sitting at, and it's part of the soundboard and everything here, right here in the studio. It's a wonderful round wood surface that we have, and thank you to Fritz Franzen, the carpenter that made it, and it just adds such a bit of elegance to our day.
Well, yeah, and it's also part of our sound effects. Sometimes when I get excited about something, I sort of bang on the table a little bit, and the engineer jumps out of his chair, and, you know, it's just, it's a real table.
Yes, it is. So welcome to our kitchen table. Today on the Donald in the Kitchen, we're going to be talking about good food and recipes for putting up the bounty, all the food this time
of
year.
Okay, this is, in terms of making radio shows, my favorite time of the year because there is so much happening from all the gardens. Everything is coming at you. Tomatoes beyond tomatoes, corn, eggplants, peppers, melons. We are in the thick of it, and it's a lot of fun. My kitchen is full of fruit flies, I have to say, from many tomatoes and melons and things like that. So this is all food all the time right now.
Good. We're going to be talking about putting by some of this, giving you a few recipes.
Or just eating it.
And eating it. And first I want to mention that Donna and I, about two weeks ago, middle of August, we went to a field day at the Iowa State University Horticulture Research Station.
Quite a big deal it is. It's very park-like, almost could be a golf course, but there's no putting greens.
Oh, they could put that in, I suppose. There's room. It's a farm. It's a big research station north of Ames, Iowa, north of the university.
It's just beautiful.
The station is comprised of 235 acres and a 15-acre lake, and they have currently more than 90 projects happening out there. These are the folks that grow all this good stuff, but they're out there measuring and taking data, and that's what the Extension Service does.
Well, yeah, they're just experimenting. Will this work, and what if we do that? And, you know, and every year, like,
and
for the last
students.
Couple of years, they had all kinds of squashes they were working on, and I must say I was the lucky recipient of some of them for pumpkin pies for Thanksgiving and things like that.
This year we went out there and kind of walked through the whole thing. Lots of things to look at, and one of the things that we noticed, they were growing melons as in cantaloupes and melons, in a greenhouse.
A hoop house. Vertically. Not only that. So it was like a jungle of vines going up with the melons here and there and lots of strings holding up the vines. I don't know how they walk through there to pick the vines. They must send the munchkins in or something.
Grad students.
Okay.
But one nice thing.
It was beautiful.
We got to taste a whole bunch of different, I think there were like 12 varieties.
At least 12.
And this is the first time I was able to taste so many melons, and they measured the Brix
B-R-I-X.
Tell Donna what a Brix is.
Okay, Brix are, they're used a lot in fruit, but also in other things too. It it's somehow, it's a gadget, and it measures the sweetness. So if something is high in Brix, it means A, it's going to taste sweet. It also means that it's probably at peak ripeness, because the higher the Brix get, the closer you are to absolute ripeness. So with melons, of course, that's very important. And, you know, I must say, I always love taste comparisons. You really, really can educate your palate. It's like having a flight of wines, for example. If you drink four wines in a row, you go, oh, well, this one really is a little more this than that, da, 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 da. So with these melons, and there were probably, what do you think, 150 people at the field day? So they had whole trays of pieces of the melons with the name of it and the amount of Brix in it.
Right.
And you could see by just tasting, the sweetness of, you know, of each one. And plus, of course, it's not just the sugars that are important in melons, but when it is sweet, the other flavors seem to come along in burst too. And it was really some delicious eating.
Yes, my palate learned a lot about melons thanks to all the good folks at the Hort Research Station for a fine
day. And all
field
of these
day.
Can obviously be grown quite well in Iowa.
Yeah, that's the whole point of this thing. They're doing, although they said the growing all of those melons in a hoop house on a trellis was kind of a hassle, so you probably want staff for that. But
right.
They did some good melons.
But the varieties could be still propagated almost anywhere. So I was at the Ames Downtown Farmers Market, you know, of course, looking for melons this weekend. So, and this is just completely standard, not just in Iowa, but a lot of other places. So mainly we have three melons, right? You get watermelons, cantaloupes, and some places you also get honeydew. And that's about the extent of it. But there are so many other kinds of melons. And one thing they were they talking about this? Something about the concept of the personal melon, which means one small enough, or the breakfast melon as they're known, you know, like in Europe. So they're small enough that you would easily eat a whole one. It's like the size of a large grapefruit mostly. And some of the varieties, like one of my favorite was a French market melon called Charente, which has these, it's a cantaloupe, it's orange kind of, but it's very butterscotchy and really, really sweet. And then of course there are the more, you know, light green colored and almost yellow, and there's just so many possibilities. We could be growing. Oh, I do have a story. Okay. So I try to walk my mile every day, and I've been walking down by the Skunk River, except for the shooting range, which is over there. That is my favorite place to walk. And there are some community raised bed gardens down there. So I was down there walking, and I see this young woman picking shiso. I'm going, all right, there are not very many shiso pickers in Ames, Iowa, right? So I say to her, oh, shiso, I love shiso. What do you do with it? She said, well, in my South Korean heritage, we do a lot of things with shiso, and one of the things is they take the leaves and they make like a spicy cooked meat thing, and they use it for a wrap, and they eat it like that. Shiso is also, it's a very good digestive and things like that. But the other thing she was growing, she only had two things in her patch, were melons. And she said, I'm also growing these Korean melons that I can't get anywhere else. And she was so lovely, she insisted that I take one home, which of course I did. They're small, like the personal size, and they're a little elongated like a football, and they were kind of green and yellow striped. You might have even thought they were a squash, but she told me, and I've never done this before, she said, peel it like a potato.
What?
Yeah, you just peel the skin off, it's very thin, so I did that, and she said, and you eat the seeds and all, like you would in a cucumber. So I did that, and I must say, I had a melon experience like I have never had in my life. It was, I don't know what they're called. I don't know how to find them again. It is a Korean melon, but it was such a treat. The outer part, once you get the peel off, was kind of, honeydewish, like light green, but the seed part in the middle, it didn't have as many seeds as a cantaloupe. It was more like a cucumber. But the absolutely sweetest part of the melon was the bit that was holding the seeds. The flavor was exquisite.
Oh, my.
It was really, really...
So, a wonderful experience.
Right? Total accident. Just loved it.
Oh.
But it's okay. Melon season. Get out there and eat your melons and have at it.
Oh, and melons are so
good. And the other thing I did the other day with this melon I got at the farmer's market is I put, I was at my Georgian friend's house, and there's a salt condiment from Georgia that has things like fenugreek, a little bit of cumin, not dominating, some marigold leaves. It's something typically Georgian, but we sprinkled that on the cantaloupe. Oh, my goodness. I said, Gio, you have to give me some of the salt to take home because I can never eat cantaloupe without the salt again. It was so good. There, you know, I grew up eating salt on my cantaloupe. Did you do that too?
No.
Huh? That must be a...
I mean, it was an option. I think my dad used salt on, but I like stuff just plain, thank you.
Well, they're good just plain, but they're also really good with salt or kind of flavored salts and things like that, which will lead us to later our conversation about corn.
Yes,
but we have got those whole melons now
today. We got a whole bunch of stuff. So before we get into, well, let's save corn for a while because I want to ask you about some tomato adventures.
Oh, it is tomato time, isn't it, Lana?
Yes, it is.
It is. Well, you know, our go-to, and Lana and I will proudly tell you this, is first of all, it's a really good way to use a lot of tomatoes. If you just have so many, you just don't even know what to do with them, is our oven candied tomato recipe, which is on the KHOI Donalana Kitchen recipe section. But it is basically on a cookie pan with sides, you know, a sheet pan. You spray the bottom of the pan, you cut the tomatoes. I have been, like, I got a whole bunch of Roma tomatoes from Helen Gunderson. And I just cut them in half. Mm-hmm. You put the skin side down on the sheet, and then salt, pepper, and I sometimes put a little basil or a little marjoram or a little oregano, some dried herb that you just kind of sprinkle all over, and then spray some olive oil again. Then, Lana, explain about the roasting part, because she's more precise than me.
The idea is starting it hot, and I started, it depends on your oven now, but I started at... And I do two pans at a time just because I got lots of
tomatoes.
Well,
yeah, you're running the oven. Yeah. You might as well do.
I start at 425, cook at 425 for half an hour, turn it down to 400 for half an hour, 350 for half an hour, 300 half an hour, 250 half an hour. But you're watching it. I mean, so it depends on how wet.
Yeah, you have to peek in the oven because... If the tomatoes are more thinly sliced or smaller, those will cook faster.
They may be done by 250.
Right, and you don't want to, like, I had a mixed tray where I had different sizes, which is not what you're supposed to do. But so what I did is as the smaller pieces started to be more cooked, I just took the spatula and took those out and kept cooking the fatter pieces.
Yeah, but what this does, it semi-dehydrates it. But it saves all of that fantastic juice.
Oh, yes.
And at the end, you can either just turn off the oven, go away, come back the next morning, or just open the door of the oven for a little bit and let it even cool off a bit more. And then I scoop them into freezer bags and put them in the freezer, or you can use them right in the refrigerator in a covered jar. They're pretty good.
And if you pour a bit more olive oil over them when they're done, they will stay in the fridge for quite a long time. I'm not sure, but I don't know why you couldn't also either hot pack them or pack them in a jar and can them if you wanted to.
If you wanted to, yeah.
Yeah, but Lana and I we're kind of over that already. So so we do some freezing or we keep them. But they are so good. Like I did I know this sounds completely silly, but I had some really good corn tortillas. So I flipped them over on the flame, popped in one of those tomatoes, put a little taco seasoning salt on it, and I just ate it like that. I mean, they're just so good. They're wonderful in sandwiches. They're great on pasta.
Good thing to do.
Yeah, you can just, and this is when you're tired of eating, you know, in the beginning, you just want fresh sliced tomatoes, you know, and you eat that. And then after a while, it's like, there's too many tomatoes to be doing that. So this is when you really are running through the tomatoes, and it's a great way to preserve them.
Yes, and when you pull out those bags, either from the freezer or if you can tomatoes, or however you do it, long about January and February, you will be glad that you did.
Yeah.
Also, Donna, you are having some adventures with pickled and fermented, and you got a recipe.
Okay, this
from
is
one
the
of our,
ongoing
one of our,
yeah. update. Yeah, Gail Hickenbottom sent us this wonderful recipe for pickled. So then and Lana and I had two Ukrainian cookbooks which talked about fermenting. So and Gio, our man from Georgia, brought some jars of pickled tomatoes too, which it was revelatory just to. A pickle, a tomato that tastes like a pickle, but a tomato. It's really good. So there seem to be two things you could do. You can either ferment, like a salt fermentation, or you can pickle with vinegar, or you can do a combination. I mean, I've looked at about 15 recipes now and tried to figure out what to do. So I launched into one this week that is a salt ferment.
Ah.
And it was sort of a combination of recipes. There's no vinegar in it. So this is an experiment, and I'm trying it because if it's really good, hopefully tomato season will still be happening, and we can make more. Because this takes 2 weeks. So first you put, let's see, how did, you take a boiled clean, I used a 2-quart jar because that's the size of my experiment. And then you pack it with the one consistent thing from the Eastern European recipes is they all say to either put in horseradish leaves and or black currant leaves. They say that whatever is in those leaves keeps them crispier. So I happen to have those both in my garden. So I put those in with dill, a bay leaf, some allspice, some peppercorns, onion, garlic, of course, sliced thin, and then I just put salt water, a certain percentage, which I can't remember at the moment. I hope I wrote it down in case it works. And then you pack all this into the freshly boiled jar, and then you cover it all with the salt water. And then, like in most fermenting things, you have to make sure that everything is submerged. So then I took a smaller canning jar and set it on the very top of it to keep the top tomato from bubbling out.
Now, question. You just put in raw tomatoes.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Well, but the salt water that I poured all, and there were options. Some people said, put the hot salt water over, but this will split your tomatoes, or not put salts, just put cooled salt water over. I chose the hot method. You know, I'm gambling. There's so many variables there. So at the moment, then you set it in the pantry for 3 days, so it's like fermenting, and then you put it in the refrigerator for 2 weeks. So I put it in the refrigerator on Sunday, and I will let you know in 2 weeks how it goes. And if it's really good, we'll make some more. But it is beautiful because I use different colors of tomatoes.
Beautiful is
beautiful,
good.
Beautiful,
we're
beautiful,
starting.
Beautiful.
We're starting.
And I want to try some with vinegar in them, too.
Good,
I think. Have you thought about doing any vinegared ones?
No. I had a recipe for pickled tomatoes that I got from my cousin Dave.
Oh.
And I liked it when he made it. I made it. And he made it with cherry tomatoes, which was good, but I couldn't get over the taste was great. I couldn't get over the texture of biting into a gushy cherry tomato. Somehow it reminded me too much of eyeballs. So, it was good. Tasted
okay,
good.
Okay, here's what I learned from Gio. His mother's pickled, so the Georgian mother, right? What you do is you use bigger tomatoes, mm-hmm. you know, like maybe a 2-inch tomato, mm-hmm. and you sort of bite into it and you suck the innards out of it.
That's it.
That's the trick.
That's it. That's it. Because you know, this is not a mouthful. This is kind of a mouthful and a half. So that the proper way to eat a pickled tomato.
Yes.
You learned about it here. And we'll keep our ear to the ground and see how these things turn out. Yes, yes, yes. I have had a good tomato year, and I would like to report on some tomatoes that did really well and some not so. I had really good luck with yellow tomatoes, and I love yellow tomatoes this year.
Those peach fuzz ones,
oh,
right?
Oh, the peach fuzzy ones are just
beautiful.
Great. The gold brandy wines and the persimmons were fantastic. My regular brandy wines and Caspian pink are big pink ones are lovely, too, although they tend to split, so you have to kind of watch it. A good red one I had this year was Trophy from Seed Savers Exchange. And let's see. I grew Ukrainian Purple, which is a lovely tomato, but it's not as purple as it looks as you want. It's a pear-shaped tomato or a long Roma-shaped. It sort of is a
that
funny color.
That might be
color.
A good one to pickle. How big are they? No, Lana. Inches. We're on radio.
Oh, I was holding my hands up to, I'd say 4 inches long.
Oh, that's kind of big, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it is. You'd have to cut it open. I was expecting they'd be little, but
but
they're okay. And also, those split, too, and I always like my green zebras. One, I grew a tomato called Rainbow. Big slicer. It's beautiful. It's yellow. It has a starburst in the middle, so you open it up, and there's a red starburst. And I must say, it's beautiful to look at, but compared to everything else, the taste wasn't all that good. It reminded me of Jim Hightower, a writer, a columnist, a social activist.
Often a wonderful curmudgeon.
A curmudgeon often refers to something as being all hat and no cattle. So, it was gorgeous. It looked like it'd really be something. And at least for
it was
mine.
Just superficial, right?
Well, it was pretty. I like a good tasting tomato. So, although it was impressive, that's fine.
Come on, tell us what failed this year.
That one is fine. My taxi, yellow, little yellow tomatoes, the deer ate them.
They must have been really good.
Just plain ate them. My Costolutos didn't do well at all. I don't know why.
Maybe too dry. Huh?
Maybe too dry, nothing. My Cherokee Purples grew big, cracked, and didn't do too well. However, and I usually have trouble with these. Black Crims did just dandy. So,
now how big are the Black Crims?
Now those aren't very big.
Oh, now those might be. Maybe we should try those for making
3 inches,
the
2 inches.
The pickled size.
Yeah, and they didn't crack as that. It all depends on your soil, and the rain. Yes, we got a rain. It was good. It was good. Also, I always grow tiny tomatoes, which are currant size, and they taste delicious. You can't do, if you want to pickle those, you're going to be there for a long time because they're the size of a currant. Tiny, but they taste so good. Different varieties do different things, and those were some of my favorites this year. Yeah.
Well, I do have one recipe that I'm going to try that I just discovered last night. So I have next week we're going to do the pantry show?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so anyway, I have 3 new cookbooks. Every once in a while, I just have to buy cookbooks and kind of refresh my brain. So one of them that I got is the New York Times Cooking. It's called the No Recipe Recipes. Now, that's right up my alley, right? So, and the author is Sam Sifton. He writes often in the New York Times. But this is his brown butter tomato salad, it says. This recipe demands perfect tomatoes, which is right now. The sort you generally only find for a month or so each year at the end of the summer when perfect tomatoes are all you want to eat. So he says, serve with good bread for mopping up the butter and tomato juices. All it takes is tomato and butter. So
butter.
Let me read you this. Okay, because the whole book is he kind of just gives descriptions. He doesn't give amounts. He just says, glug of olive oil, blah, blah, blah. So he says, cut some tomato beauties into thick planks and arrange them prettily on a platter. Heat some good butter. as opposed to bad butter, I suppose, some good butter in a pan until it is foamy and just starting to turn nutty and brown. Then spoon it all over the tomatoes. Neatly, please, as they do at a restaurant. Sprinkle coarse salt over the top of the mixture. Come winter, you'll try it again with wan tomatoes, and it won't be the same. So what could be simpler?
Butter and tomatoes. Yeah. I'm going to go try.
We're going to have that for dinner tonight, I think.
I think so,
yeah.
Too.
It's just, what could be simpler? And it's still the right season for this.
It is. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Kitchen, and we are so excited. We're getting a little silly here because there are so many recipes and so little time, and the vegetables are rolling in. We're talking about good stuff from the garden.
What are we doing next? Eggplant? Oh, no, corn.
How about you talk corn? I think
corn
is
good. Oh, corn. Well, I have to say, Lana and I have, although there's been a lot more different people growing corn this year, but we have our corn man, Ray Olson, who's at the farmer's market. And I'm not saying other people don't do this. I don't really know. But Ray, first of all, he picks it early morning when it's as cool as possible and refrigerates it immediately. He also plants successive plantings of different varieties that kind of switch it up a little bit, and he's very particular about his variety. He only grows corn for market, so he's really into it. And I buy corn all over town, because with Ray, he's only at the farmer's market on Saturdays, but his is noticeably better.
Recommendation,
yes,
from Dennis.
Yes.
Then what do you do with Ray's corn?
Oh, golly, anything. After you've eaten your fill of the first corn, I always eat it slightly steamed with nothing on it. You just want to, it's like the first tomatoes. You just want to taste it. And then you launch into the typical, salt, pepper, and butter. Then you start cutting it off the cob for corn salad, corn chowder. I did a cream corn this year, kind of southern style.
Oh, do tell.
You make a white sauce with a roux, butter. I think I put onions, sautéed some onions in butter, got them nice brown and mushy. Then I added the flour. Then I stirred in some milk, maybe a little cream. Then I have a new thing. It's not that new, but I really like bay leaves in a lot of things. And sometimes I grind my own bay leaves in a pinch. But the thing is, to grind bay leaves, you need to do a bunch, because the food, the food mill, it can't just grind one bay leaf. I mean, you could use a mortar and pestle, but it isn't. So Burlap and Barrel, the place that we order, sustainably, equitably sourced, whatever. They have really good herbs from farmers all over the world. They have a new thing of just a jar of powdered bay, which is wonderful. Now, you gotta go easy, because it's really concentrated when it's powdered like that. Just a little FYI right here. Where I got into the powdering the bay, if you're cooking liver and onions, and you put the bay, quite a bit, bay on the liver with salt and pepper, and then fry it. OMG.
Oh, I've really tried that, and really I do good. Like liver and onions.
Anyway, so with the cream corn, I put in some thyme, which I picked right out of the garden, and the bay, and salt and pepper. And it was, of course, delicious. And this time of year, unlike canned cream corn, you make the sauce, and you carve the corn right off the cob, and don't overcook it.
Oh.
Just barely cook it. Then it's really got that fresh pop of flavor.
Ooh, cream corn.
Cream corn.
How
yeah,
nice.
Really good. Really good.
How nice.
What else we... Well, there's all kinds of things you can put on your
yes
corn. You can grill it. You can steam it. You can whatever. And then toppings, you know. Chili peppers. Chili and lime. What do you like on your corn?
There is a local couple that makes seasoned salt in this area.
Oh, right.
The salt liquor people. And yeah. They make one called Peter Rabbit, and I like that one. It's
does it have dill in it? What's
it's
it called?
Dill and radishes. And, and it's really good. And there's also one they call French Tickler with all kinds of, I know we laugh about, but that's the name of it. And that's kind of an Herbes de Provence kind of thing with lavender in it.
Oh,
that is really good on corn. I like that. There's a recipe here. Just talk about the what they put on corn. There's a chef called Otto Lenge who has this great big book, and he's got
lots of great big books. I think he's. He's from Jerusalem, but his main thing happens in London. And he's got something called corn ribs here.
And I've seen other recipes. Maybe you notice this, too, on the Internet or whatever. Instead of cooking whole cobs of corn, people with really good chef's knives and really strong arms are splitting the cobs vertically. So they end up with long
with a little bit of cob,
which holds the corn.
And I have to say, I have never done this, so we're not speaking from experience.
And actually, they say be careful.
You need a really sharp knife because you are cutting into the cob. But he does all kinds of, like, he fries them up, and he puts something, black lime and pumpkin seed butter.
Fancy schmancy. He takes pumpkin seeds, toasts them, and sautés them in butter and mixes it all together. And I'm familiar with black lime as a seasoning.
Black lime.
What is
this?
Black
is another
lime
thing that you can order from Burlap and Barrel. Black lime is a Persian thing, tradition. Although Burlap and Barrels come from actually a lime grower in Guatemala, but the process is, you pick the limes, and you soak them in salt water brine for a while, and then you sun dry them until they get black. And then in the Persian tradition, you buy them whole, dried out in the market, and you just grate them. But at Burlap and Barrel, they have them already grated, and they give this lovely citrusy zing.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
It looks like black dust when you put it up, but it tastes absolutely fantastic. So it's another one of those things. I'm not going to be fermenting my or doing my own black lime.
No, but it's really easy to just buy some
that
of that
is good.
From Burlap and Barrel. It's an online thing, and yeah. If you go to their site, you will be fascinated with the. And I have to say, everything that I have ever ordered from them has really, it's very fresh, has really good flavors. So he's got, this is the Otto Lenge thing for corn ribs. So he's got, you make a pumpkin seed butter by, you know, toasting the pumpkin seeds, and then, you know, like if you would make your, probably food processor, with unsalted butter for the oil, and then some black limes in it, sea salt. And then he's got a tiny little bit of honey in this.
Yeah,
so, I mean, you can get so creative with these things.
It's, salt and butter is good just too.
Different kind of butter, so it's... seed butter.
Now I found one little picture on the Internet. Another thing you could put on your corn, if you really are so inclined, butter it first, and then roll it in crushed hot Cheetos.
Well, that would give you the salt element, you know?
It certainly would. And the picture was amazing because it was the Cheeto orange. But you can put anything on your corn. Yes, you can.
Yes, my mother would call it gilding the lily.
Gilding the lily.
Yeah.
you found you mentioned shiso earlier, which is an herb that looks an awful lot like basil, but it is not. And then you sent me this recipe for cucumbers.
Well, I have a lot of shiso in the garden. I actually bought the plant from one of the farmers at the farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And the lovely thing about shiso is if you let it grow in the fall, it drops its seeds. And then next year you have a lot more shiso. So, and shiso is, there are different kinds of shiso. There's the red shiso, which is called perilla also in Italian. And then the Japanese-y version is all green with kind of fluffy large leaves. And then there's also a Korean one I have, which is red on one side and green on the other side. So apparently, the red one is used, first of all, if you're brewing tea or something, it makes everything this beautiful pink color, kind of like a hibiscus color, but a different flavor. And then, like umeboshi plums, which are used a lot in macrobiotic and Japanese things, are pink because of the shiso leaves that they're packed with. So apparently in Japanese cuisine, the red perilla forms are used mostly in cooking things. They're also called beefsteak leaves.
Oh, yeah, that's a very unappetizing name for it. But yes, they are called that. They're either red and they're kind of...
But I have a lot of the green one, and so I've been looking for things to do. Like, I made a plum... Let's see, it's a syrup. So I have it for beverages, for cocktails, for... It's just sugar. I put some plums in it. There were not many plums this year, but I did get a few local plums from Helen Gunderson's house. And so I boiled down the plums with the sugar, and then I put a lot of shiso in it, and I kind of let it steep for a while till it, you know, cooled off at room temperature. And then I pressed the whole thing through my food mill to get as much plum out of it as I could. And then I stuck it in the fridge, and I'm mixing it with like either club soda or I did a wonderful thing. I took a watermelon.
Oh no.
Cut up the pieces of watermelon, put it in the blender with the shiso stuff, the shiso syrup, I should say. OMG. That's my
good.
Thing today. I'm just been having so many flavor sensations. It was really delicious. So I have some of this pink shiso syrup sitting in there.
Good. Good.
The other thing I'm going to try, and we'll let you know, is I'm going to make some shiso salt. But I looked up a recipe from Food 52, which is a website that Lana and I have talked about, and they have... It's one of our recommended websites as opposed to some. Their recipes are reliably good.
Well, as opposed to the hot Cheeto one. Well, I don't know.
Well, that could be good too,
Good,
but anyway, with Food 52, they are testing their recipes, and they have some cookbooks which are wonderful. So this is Quick Cucumber and Shiso Pickles, right? So it's... she says, I keep a version of this in the fridge all summer long. Carrots, radishes, cucumbers, onions, celery, or any other vegetables available. Marinated in vinegar, shiso, mirin, and sugar. Mirin is a rice wine, not vinegar. But you can buy it at, you know, any kind of Asian store or the local co-op. It's kind of not sweet, but a little sweet. So she says... she always includes cucumbers. They're crisp and cool, perfect as a garnish, a summer chutney with fish or chicken. They can be ready in 4 hours or 4 days. I slice the cucumbers on the blade side of a box grater. That's a little tedious. I would just slice them. But here, so it says, shiso and pickles should hang out more often. The aromatic green leaves, shiso gives this, she calls it an herbaceous lift It's really good. They say reminiscent of cinnamon cloves and ginger all at once. I don't think that's true. It's just a thing. So here is her recipe. A quarter cup of sugar, half cup. She uses apple cider vinegar. Frankly, I would use an unseasoned rice wine vinegar. I think apple cider vinegar is a little too intense. 3 tablespoons of mirin, which is that rice wine stuff. Tablespoon of salt, 5 Japanese cucumbers or 2 English cucumbers, and then 8 shiso leaves. So shiso leaves are rather large, and what she says to do, and this is a good way to use them, is I will describe it. Gather the shiso leaves like a deck of cards, you know, just stack them up, roll them into a tube, and slice them chiffonade style like you would basil, which means you end up with like long, so you've got the, you roll it up like a little cigar kind of thing, and then you just take your knife and cut them to like, oh, 1/8 of an inch thick or so. And that leaves you these long little pieces.
That sounds good.
We'll have that for dinner too, right?
See, another good thing to try, another recipe. This is good. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a waltz. Everyone needs a waltz every now and then, called Murr's Waltz. Well, we're going to dive back into the Donna Lana Kitchen archives here from a show from 2019. We talked to Ben Hoksh, and Ben Hoksh is somebody that knows a lot about the natural world, what's out there, what's good to eat. He talks, this is a little show that we talked to him about his work with butterflies and milkweed, and not just the butterflies, but he knows a lot about the milkweed too, including eating it.
I'm a forager, and I'm going to be talking to you today about milkweed and monarchs. Yeah, so I am part of a project out at Camp Dodge Military Base, funded through the Department of Defense and Tufts University out of Boston. Out there, I'm part of a 3-year study that's looking at disease transfer in monarch butterflies. So, you know, everyone's, you know, concerned about their overwintering numbers down in Mexico, and some of us have been lucky enough to go down there and see the pine trees covered in you know, living leaves of sorts. I haven't made it myself, but I would love to make it down to Michoacan, to the mountains, to see that. So people are planting milkweed in their yards of various kinds and colors and shapes. Iowa has something like, I want to say 17 or 19 different species of milkweed. You know, we usually think of butterfly weed or common milkweed, you know, the ones with the globe-like purple flowers that get tall, or the butterfly weed that's got the bright orange tops that, like, you know, your drier or rockier sites. But there are a whole bunch of other ones out there as well. So the study is just kind of looking at how diseases move and if we need to be worried about it or not. So I take a little sticker and I put them on the little butterfly's abdomen and take a little scale sample and see if it's got the presence of or absence of these spores. And I take a little gel pen, I put a couple of colors on their wings, you know, whether it's purple, green, blue, orange, so I know that this one is Mary and the other one is Joe and, you know, how far they've gone that day. I swear it's every 5-year-old girl's dream for a job, but I've managed to land it for a couple of summers. you know, we're finding that, at least at Camp Dodge, there's not a lot of this disease to worry about. But it's something that, you know, if we have more habitat, there's more room for butterflies to spread out, and we may not really have to worry about this in the future. But I'm glad to be a part of the study. Now, on top of planting all this milkweed in your yards, if you've listened to the show before, I am an advocate for eating wild food, you know. So this milkweed, common milkweed specifically, is a great wild food to eat. So this season, and during this time of year, some of the plants are just starting to make little tiny flowers, and they look like little cauliflower buds that are hanging up towards the top of the tree. You know, they're about the size of a ping pong ball right now. In places that don't get as much sun, they may be a little shorter, and the tops of the plants may be pretty flexible. I guess what I'm trying to say is that this whole plant is edible and pretty good. Early in the season, I'll break off the tops of the plants and strip a couple of the leaves off, so there's just a couple of little ones on top. And you kind of just feel for that rubbery part like you're harvesting asparagus, and where it snaps is the place that you grab it. You can eat these straight up raw if you want to. They're not too bad. You know, the latex in there doesn't really come through, you know, when you're chewing on them. They may get on your finger and feel a little sticky, but the flavor is very pleasant. They're great sauteed up or grilled just like asparagus. Just be cautious when you get around this time of year to be looking for little caterpillar eggs on the bottom side of the leaves or little caterpillars themselves, you know, nibbling on them. So maybe avoid those or brush the caterpillars off to another plant. Milkweeds are very resilient. You know, if you break them off, they're going to just sprout right back and they're probably going to even do better. You know, especially because milkweeds are a food source the whole season in Iowa. So if you cut down your first crop of milkweed and you let a second one regrow, you're going to be allowing really fresh, vibrant food for butterflies when kind of the other plants are getting a little leathery and a little older, you know, and not as tender for the caterpillars. Now, mentioning these little flower buds again, I like to take those and saute them up. I've also seen them pickled, you know, just like you would a pepper or, you know, a green bean. They have a really nice texture to them, a little bit of a floral taste, a nice chew, and a nice addition to just about anything. Now, even later in the season, when these flowers open up, it's make these big globe-like flowers, and they've got these little traps in each one of the little flowers for the butterfly feet to get stuck in. You know, monarchs are members of the brush-footed family of butterflies. So they've got these really sticky hairs on their feet, and if you ever see one on top of a milkweed feeding, them and other insects will actually get their feet stuck inside of the flowers. And when they pull them out, they get covered in these little pollen sacs, and then they help pollinate the other flowers out there. But I go through and I snip off a couple of those flowers for myself because, well, I don't think the monarchs mind sharing with me. And I make cordials with those. So I make a flavored soda with that and a little bit of lemon juice and sugar. And it's a really nice, bright pink, you know, floral tasting beverage for the summer. Beyond that, you know, when I think of milkweeds, if we're looking to plant for monarchs, the research shows that common milkweed is probably the best host plant for butterflies. Maybe not the best nectar source, but definitely the best host plant. So the caterpillars survive the best on the common milkweed. If you have a friend that has a patch, you know, you can get some seeds in the ground, but the easiest way to get it going is just take a shovel to the inside of it in the early spring, grab a couple of those shoots and put them into your garden, because milkweeds spread mostly by roots when they're out in the prairie. although they do make some really beautiful cottony seeds, you know, later in the season.
You mean all of that business up on top with those wonderful flying seeds and that beautiful cone that pops open? That's just all for show? There's a lot of it going on underneath the ground.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, who doesn't do a little bit of something just for show? Yeah, that's probably the best way to get them established. You know, if you see a big patch of milkweed out in the prairie, you know, I usually expect them to be the same individual. You know, like you would see a black locust tree or an aspen grove. It's all roots underground that are just making new shoots. So you're not going to be harming anything by grabbing a little chunk from your neighbor's fence row or, you know, your nearby butterfly garden if you get permission to dig a little piece.
Good. Wonderful things about butterflies and milkweed. And, of course, Ben tells me you can eat them, too. We always learn something new when you talk to Ben Hawks.
Milkweed. And there's other stuff out there, too. Donna, tell us about eggplant. It's such a pretty thing that grows. And you make a really good recipe with eggplant.
Well, there's we're getting more diversity in eggplants in the market here. I mean, it used to be just get the big purple ones. That's the classic. Also known as aubergine, and if you're using English cookbooks. But now we're getting, like, some Japanese ones, the long, skinny, some, and some white ones, so some Oro Blancos. But, there's some small differences in texture, but basically I don't find a lot of differences in flavor, except for there are some small Indian varieties, which I think are extremely bitter. And I know if you're into that cuisine, they work perfectly for that. But otherwise, you're probably the average American is not going to especially love those kind. But my favorite thing with eggplant, which of course has many, many uses, is I make something called caponata, which is a Sicilian relish dish, basically. You cook the eggplants, you can cut them in cubes and roast them. I just throw it all in the pot. It's onions, eggplant. It does not have garlic in it, okay? Onions, eggplant, olive oil, a little tomato or tomato paste, and then it gets celery, basil, and then in the end, after it's cooked, you can put more fresh chopped basil and fresh chopped parsley. I put in some peppers, trying for a little color, maybe some yellow and red peppers, sweet peppers. And you kind of just saute this all up until it's a mush, and then it gets a little sweet sour thing. So you're using a little sugar, a little vinegar. For herbs, I do put in, as I'm cooking it down, I do use a good amount of ground coriander seeds. Now, this is not cilantro. This is the coriander seed. And a little chocolate powder for bitterness. But you want the sweet and sour thing. Then at the end, when you're putting in the fresh basil and the capers, and fresh basil, fresh parsley, capers, sliced olives, and a little vinegar. So you end up with a It's very definitely sweet and sour, and you just let it sit for a little while, and it can, it improves a day or two in the fridge as well. But it's like you put some on a crusty piece of bread, or, you can do things with it. It's a little relishy kind of dish.
Yeah, it's a thing to put on top of bread and snack away. It is really, really good. A good thing to do with eggplant. Eggplant tapenade.
No, caponata. C-A-P-O-N-A-T-A. Caponata.
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 Okay. See? Donna keeps me on the straight and narrow with all my recipes here. I just eat what she puts in front of me. It's wonderful. Caponata is fantastic. Thank you for that recipe. Good. Well, where has summer gone? We have to eat all these fresh summer vegetables. And
what a hardship.
What a hardship. And keep listening to the Donna in the Kitchen for more recipes. Next week we are going to dive into what Donna wants to start calling our pantry show, because it's a lot of tricks of the trade, and we've got some great recipe books to share with you. We'll have a good time doing that.
Oh, we love to talk about food, no problem.
Right. You've been listening to the Donna in the Kitchen.
We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. We come to you every Tuesday live at noon at KHOI Community Radio. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.